Most of us have never had the pleasure of having your car run out of gas and having to push it. But if you've ever had that experience, you can really appreciate what gasoline does for a car. With gasoline, the car moves effortlessly. The burden of the tremendous weight of the car never even enters our minds. We simply get in the car, turn on the key, and the car moves. And it's a wonderful experience, but as I say, it comes at a cost. And that is, you have to put fuel into the vehicle, or it's going to become a tremendous burden instead of a tremendous opportunity. And that's a lot like Christianity. Some of us look upon Christianity as a tremendous burden. Difficult to push, difficult to handle. As we go on day after day, we really feel that we don't know if we can continue on. But just as there is fuel for the car, there is fuel for our emotions. And as we consider the power of these emotions, it lightens the load of Christianity to the point where it almost feels like the car. It almost feels like you are effortlessly moving because these motivations are so wonderful. And so before we even get into the scriptures this morning, I'd just like for all of us to think about that. I can get pretty strong as far as the responsibilities and obligations of Christianity. And week after week after week, it may seem like it's a tremendous burden. But my goal is to make sure that when we stand before Jesus on the judgment day, we hear, "Well done, good and faithful servant." And you can't do too much to get that. And so as we compare our lives to the scriptures, sometimes, as I say, we begin to feel like this is a pretty heavy load. But yet Jesus said, "You'll find rest unto your souls. My burden is easy and it is light." And if we don't find that, if we don't find, as Paul said, "For our light affliction, which is but for a moment, is working for us an eternal weight of glory." And so to get the best, we're going to need the best. We've talked about this in the past. These Olympic runners, these Olympic contenders who spend 10, 12 hours a day, week after week, denying themselves, pushing themselves, and yet for them, it is never a burden. And they relish when the coach gives them more things to do that makes it even harder because they want to be the best. And so as we look at these scriptures, how often do they come into our minds? Paul says, "I press on. I'm never content. I'm always pushing to gain more responsibility and obligation, if by any means I might attain to the resurrection of the dead." The resurrection of the dead was Paul's motivation, and it worked for Paul the same way that gasoline works in our car. And it makes the load seem effortless. It makes the load seem like it's just moving by itself. Paul said, "I reckon the sufferings of this world are not worthy to be compared with the glory that shall be revealed to us." Now, Paul weighed it out, and Paul said to himself, the responsibilities and obligations of being a Christian compared to what Christianity will offer to us in the end, suddenly Christianity becomes a light burden. As he said, it's not even worthy. There's no way to compare the sufferings with the glory. Those people in the Old Testament were looking for the recompense of reward. That's what they were looking at. And because they weren't looking at the responsibilities and obligations, it's very similar to those spies. We had 12 spies. 10 of them did not see the power of God, and they said, "This is too heavy a load. We can't push it. We can't carry it. We can't do this." They discouraged the hearts of the people. As I said, as far as Joshua and Caleb and Moses and Aaron were concerned, this was going to be an easy matter, because God was going to do all the heavy lifting. All they had to do basically is march seven times around Jericho. God knocked the walls down and God caused the people to be so afraid that for the most part they were facing the backs of people and not the fronts of people as people were running away. Jesus, for the joy that was set before him, endured the cross, and the promises of God that they were offered led them to be motivated. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who according to his great mercy has begotten us again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, to an inheritance incorruptible and undefiled and that does not fade away, reserved in heaven for you. How often, brethren, do we even think about this verse? How often does this verse come into our minds when we start to feel a little discouraged? When we start to feel like the load and the burden of working with the Church of Christ at Holly Street is too much, that we can't shoulder our responsibility. We don't want to talk about the church as a universal church. Our labor and toil primarily is here. And if we feel that because of ingratitude or because of the lack of results from our efforts or because of any other reason that we just can't hardly bear this load and we would really like to be out from under it, then we're not thinking about these things. God, according to his abundant mercy, begot us again to a living hope. Now, what's the difference between a living hope and all of the other hopes? Well, as we... I thought I had another slide there, so that's all right. Let's just talk about that. The living hope is illustrated by this particular group of people. These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. Now, these are matters of degree, and these are matters of progression. The first thing we do is we see those promises, and yeah, they're far off. They won't come until after we die. And some of them won't come until after the Lord returns. So these promises are a long way away. However, we can be assured of them. God promised. It's impossible for God to lie. We have strong assurance. We have an anchor within the veil to keep us stable and strong and for the responsibilities and obligations of Christianity to become easy and light. You know, you read Jesus' words, "Come unto me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you." And sometimes you look at that and you think to yourself, how could the Lord say that the responsibilities and obligations that he's asking us to bear, the sacrifices that we have to give up, the constant evaluations, the constant sense of unworthiness as we deal with each and every sin as it comes up, confessing it to God. And sometimes we wonder, how can that be an easy and a light load? Well, this is the answer right here. First, we see the promises afar off, and then we become assured of them, and then we embrace them. We embrace them as our promises. And once we do that, we have the motivation to keep us going throughout the rest of our life. And it's up to us to keep that full. Just like the tank, you want the car to glide effortlessly, you keep fuel in the tank and you monitor the gauge. And in the same way, as Christians, we need to do that. We need to monitor the promises and we need to see whether this world or the next world is where most of our priorities are. When the cares of the world, the desires of other things start to choke the word, the responsibilities become very heavy indeed. And so, first they saw them afar off. Second, they were assured. In other words, they accepted them by faith and recognized them and knew they were coming. Then they embraced them because they could see how valuable they were. And finally, they began to realize, this world is not my home. I'm just a stranger and a pilgrim here. Peter tells us in 1 Peter chapter 2 that we, as strangers and pilgrims, should abstain from fleshly lusts at war against the soul. We are strangers and pilgrims. Why? Because this world is not our home. We don't lay up our treasures here. we don't put this as our first priority, seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these other things are added to us. We are strangers and pilgrims. For those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. So what are we declaring? What are we declaring about God's promises? Do we see them afar off? Are we assured of them, or are they never in our minds? Are these things that motivate us when the going gets tough and we are really struggling? Do I want to do this or not? Can I handle this at this time? And we have to go back to these promises. Those who say such things declare plainly they seek a homeland. And truly, if they had called to mind that country from which they had come out, they would have had an opportunity to return. And you know something, brethren? There are many people in the Old Testament who bought up that opportunity. Balaam had an opportunity to return. And in spite of the talking donkey and in spite of God's extreme demands and warnings to him, he went back. And we see this over and over and over again. Solomon had an opportunity to return through the influence of his wife, and he bought it up. And Judas had an opportunity to return. And many of the people we know have an opportunity to return, and so do you and so do I. We all have this opportunity. As we hear the responsibilities of the gospel compared to what the denominations are asking of their people, sometimes we find it to be onerous. Attending all the services and praying without ceasing and conquering our lusts and taking personal responsibility for our sins and not just throwing it all under the grace of God. And as we look at what the world offers, some of us are thinking about that opportunity to go back. But now, verse 16, they desire a better, that is, a heavenly country. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God. Now, there are some Christians, he's ashamed that they call him God. You remember what Paul told the Jews in Romans chapter 2. The word of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. And God would be ashamed to have those kind of servants. God talks about this in the book of Isaiah when he says that these are people who are eating defiled things and committing adultery and then looking to the Gentiles and said, stay away from me because I'm more holy than you are. And God says, these are smoke in my nostrils and in my eyes. It just makes me sick to have servants like these servants. And so these are promises that can never die. That's why they are a living hope, because these are promises that go beyond the grave. And they change everything. Now, as we look at these things again, and I'm not going to spend much time except to say at the very top, these all died in faith, but the promises did not. As a matter of fact, the promises were not activated until they died. It isn't that they died in faith and they didn't receive the promises. They died without receiving the promises. But the moment they were beyond death, we see Moses and Elijah coming back with glory. So these promises are there. And the question that we have to ask ourselves, do we see them afar off? Have we embraced them? Have we been assured of them? Have we confessed that we are strangers and pilgrims on the earth? Or, as Jesus warned his disciples, remember Lot's wife. I don't believe Lot's wife was turned into a pillar of stone because she looked back out of curiosity. I believe she looked back with longing. She was leaving a life that she enjoyed. And because of that, she lost her soul. And I believe that's what Jesus is emphasizing there. Once you put your hand to the plow and you look back, you're not worthy of the kingdom of heaven. So these people that died by faith were the people who took on their responsibilities, carefully considered them, and effortlessly fulfilled them. Abraham obeyed to go. Abraham, when given an impossible promise, believed it. When Abraham was given a difficult task to do, he got up the next day and he did it. Why? Because he embraced them. He was assured of them. He saw them afar off and he recognized he's a stranger and pilgrim. And because he's a stranger and pilgrim, the things that God was asking of him were perfectly normal. They weren't above and beyond the call of duty. They were the duty. They were the responsibility. And it was never seen as an onerous task. It was seen as an opportunity. It was seen as a joy. Who, for the joy that was set before him, Jesus endured the cross. And so these are the people that God is not ashamed of. They were motivated, and it showed. And that's true of us as well. It's pretty easy to see whether a Christian is motivated or not. When you constantly have to encourage them to do the things that they should be doing, it tells you that they have a divided interest. That this church is really not their first priority. This church is not where they want to put the most of their efforts. They're kind of divided. One week they want to be here to support the work and worship God, and maybe the next week they don't. And that is obvious. It's obvious, unless you're sick or dying, that you should be here and you would want to be here. And if you're not here, it's telling that you are not properly motivated. And so we have to push. So it changes our perspective. Faith is no longer a part of life. It is life. It's all there is to life. Our faith in God, our trust in God, our desire to fulfill the responsibilities and obligations of God, their desire to be right with Him. These are life. This is what we are a part of. So we're no longer living the all-you-can-get philosophy. We're living in preparation. And life is no longer vanity of vanities. All is vanity. It is for everyone else. For anyone who is not a Christian, everything they are doing is going to be burned up. I'm going to live my life to save the environment. Well, you can save all you want, but when it gets burned up on the judgment day, all of your efforts are going to be meaningless. They didn't matter. And I'm going to spend my life fighting diseases. Well, again, that's an honorable course, but if that's all you're doing, you're wasting your time. But if you're serving God, then everything becomes meaningful because now it matters. When you die, if God forgets you, and slowly your ancestors forget you, you've never been here. You made no impact at all. Your life is meaningless. And worse than meaningless, it is a danger because the moment you die, things are going to get even more bleak than they are right now. And so I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. So the Apostle Paul, when I am weak, then I am strong. I rejoice in tribulations and persecutions and trials, because when I am weak, then I am strong. Paul didn't consider going out and preaching the gospel and having to pay the price for it as a burden. He considered it a privilege. By faith, Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. Now, I know this was not a battle for him, because as I look at the rest of his life, there is no wavering. As the Hebrew writer put it, he was faithful in all his house. He put priorities where they belong. When did he do that? When he made this choice. Just like when we choose to become Christians instead of enjoying the passing pleasures of sin. So, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he looked to the reward. For Moses, it made perfect sense. The greater sacrifice for him would have been to stay. Was it hard for him to make this decision? Because he esteemed the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt. And when we see it that way, when we see the treasures of this life as having no lasting value, and we see the efforts of putting into Christianity as having value, then we will be self-moving. No one will have to push us. We won't have to push ourselves. We won't look back and say to ourselves, I don't know why I'm not more motivated. I don't know why I'm not more faithful. I don't know why the kingdom is not more important to me. Well, I know why. It's right here. For Moses, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God, was the most logical choice he could make. And there was no question which sacrifice would be more valuable. And as I said, every indication is that the children of Israel went into the promised land, maybe about 1,200. And at the life of Christ in 33 AD, some 1,200 years later, he's still alive. He's still serving God. God allows him to come to earth and talk to Jesus about his coming death in Jerusalem. So they're there to motivate him. They're there to talk to him. What a blessed opportunity. Can you imagine what it must have been like for Moses and Elijah to get to come back and get to discuss with Jesus what was going to happen? And we're told by Luke that they came in glory. So did Moses make the right decision? He was already 40 when he made this decision. Would 80 years of the pleasures of sin and nothing after, or 1,200 years, and how many years is it now, of the glory that Paul said comes after we die? So every sacrifice now receives a reward, whereas every sacrifice we make in this world receives nothing. Jesus answered and said, assuredly I say to you, there is no one who has left house or brothers or sisters or father or mother or wife or children or lands for my sake and the gospel's who shall not receive a hundredfold now in this time, houses and brothers and sisters and mothers and children and lands with persecutions, and in the age to come eternal life. Now, Jesus makes it pretty clear. Every sacrifice you make here will be more than abundantly compensated for. Now, I don't believe that Jesus is saying that if I leave my father and mother, I'm going to get 100 fathers and mothers. But I'm going to get the equivalent of that in the love and devotion of my brethren and in the relationship I have with God. None of these things have any lasting value. It's a terrible thing to have to leave them behind. But sometimes they don't give us any choice. It's them or God. And when that choice is given, we don't have a choice. Now, as I said, for some people that's a terrible burden. For other people, it's effortless. And so, as you look at different people facing these things, some people are crying and bemoaning and agonizing, and other people are simply accepting it as a fact. Now, that doesn't mean they won't cry because they've lost something precious to them. But the crying is not because that it's a great sacrifice, but it's because of the loss of someone they love and the loss of their soul. As Paul said, my heart's desire and supplication for them is that they might be saved. And I have unceasing pain in my heart, not because he had to give them up. He had all the blessings. But because of what they were going to lose. Therefore, we do not lose heart, even though our outward man is perishing. The inward man is being renewed day by day. Now, this is what the living hope does. We see our bodies begin to decay. We see that we can't do as much as we used to do. We begin to realize that this life is finite and that it has an end. And that's when it's wonderful to look back and say to yourself, I am so glad. It's like the person who buys a retirement or puts a lot of money into his retirement when he's in his 20s. And now he's getting ready to retire and he's got all this money and he's telling himself, boy, I sure was smart in my 20s. And that's what some Christians do. They look back on all the sacrifices they made when they were young and they say to themselves, I'm so glad I trusted God. I'm so glad I have all of this that has been done. We do not lose heart, even though our outer man is perishing, yet the inward man is being renewed day by day. for our light affliction. Now, I've looked at Paul's life, and the last thing that I would say about Paul is that he had it easy. Paul said of all the apostles in chapter 3 of Corinthians, I perceive that we are doomed to die. You are rich, we are poor. We are reviled. We are considered the scum and offscouring of all things. And yet, he calls it in the second book, light affliction. Working for us a more and more exceeding eternal weight of glory. To be able to look back on a life of faithful service is a much more pleasant experience than to look back on a life of swings of the pendulum, faithfulness, unfaithfulness, decisions that are good, decisions that are bad. Verse 18, we do not look at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. That takes us back to Hebrews. They saw them afar off. They embraced them, they were assured of them, and then they said, I'm a stranger and pilgrim. That's what Paul is saying here. We don't look at the things which are seen anymore, but at the unseen things. Because the things which are seen are temporary, but the things that are not seen are eternal. So where do we want to focus? If you want a self-driving Christian life, where it seems like you just push on a pedal and everything is moving, and by that I mean we're praying, we're worshiping, we're studying the scriptures, we're getting strengthened and renewed day by day, and life becomes normal. It's not that we are struggling more than others, it's that we're doing what we should be doing more than others. Do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but one receives a prize? Now, this takes us back again to the Olympic Games and the stories of the sacrifices that they make. You know, during the Winter Olympics, we were hearing about these people who had fallen and broken a leg and how they had made the sacrifices to come back. And I'm thinking to myself, I think I'd just hang it up after the first broken leg. But these people don't look at it that way. Just like some people would look at me and say, what a fool for making all those sacrifices for Christ. Well, it just depends on your perspective. These people are looking for a prize. So are we. Run in such a way that you may obtain it. And everyone who competes for the prize is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a perishable crown, but we for an imperishable crown. As I say, if a coach has to force the athlete day after day to do the work that he needs to done, he's never going to receive a gold medal. Gold medals are reserved for those people who are motivated, self-motivated, based on what? Based on their ability to visualize what their goal is and then work hard to get it. And that's what those people did in Hebrews chapter 11. And that's what we're doing. Paul says here, I discipline my body and bring it into subjection, lest when I preach to others, I myself should be disqualified. And so when your coach, if you're an Olympic contender, teaches you a way to make more sacrifices so you can get better, he rejoices. He's happy with that. But what about a preacher? What about the preacher when he is coaching you to make sacrifices? Are you going to go home happy that there's more you can do? Are you going to go home shaking your head saying, I sure wish that preacher would preach more positive lessons? And it's up to us to determine which one is more important. Paul told Timothy, reprove, rebuke, exhort. But every one of those has to do with responsibility. Even exhortations are not simply, boy, these promises are wonderful and the grace of God is wonderful. No, the grace of God teaches us to deny ungodliness and worldly lusts and to live soberly and righteously and godly in this present age. And so regardless of how a preacher is preaching the truth, when he's preaching the promises, he's not your friend if he doesn't teach you like Paul said here. I've got to discipline my body and bring it into subjection, lest when I preach to others, I myself should be disqualified. But you take that verse, and in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, he says, that's a light affliction. To have to buffet my body and to bring it into subjection, to have to make sacrifices, that's simple, that's easy. Like I said, it would be hard not to if you really believed it. And that's the point of this, and that's the question we all have to ask ourselves, and that is, do I believe this? Because if you don't use the power that God has given, it's going to be nearly impossible to do it. You know, if you think about what you'd have to do every day if you didn't have electricity, and how much harder it would be to wash your clothes and wash the dishes and cook the food and heat the house, everything would become a very, very difficult task. But with that electricity, it's effortless. You throw the dishes into the dishwasher and you come back an hour later and they're clean. You put the clothes in the washer, you come back later and they're clean. How much work did you do? Well, I picked them up and put them in. Well, that's what these motivations will do for the Christian. And if you don't believe it, just try it. Just try to think about these things more than you're thinking about anything else. And pretty soon, you're going to find yourself in a totally different mindset. So we have to decide whether we're choosing the right examples. On the one side, we can look at the great cloud of witnesses that that the Hebrew writer has just described in chapter 11. Matter of fact, the passage we started with, the embracing, the seeing afar off, the stranger and pilgrim. We're surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses. They all did that. Let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. Now, Paul's just dealt with that. They exercise self-control in all things to get the prize. For them, it's effortless. They wouldn't want to live any other lifestyle than the one they're living of sacrifice and deprivation and difficulties, because that's their motivation at that particular time in their life. Now, the other side of the coin is evil company corrupts good habits, or evil companionship corrupts good morals. If your friends at work are more important to you than your friends in the Scriptures, then you're going to find this a real struggle. If your friends on the television are more important to you than the friends you have in the Scriptures, they're going to corrupt you. And you're going to find it very difficult and onerous and heavy, like pushing a car, to be a Christian. But if you make friends with those people in the Old Covenant, your fathers, your examples, your great cloud of witnesses, things will change completely. So we have to choose our companions carefully. Peter says, "Grace and peace be multiplied to you in the knowledge of God and of Jesus our Lord, as his divine power has given to us all things that pertain to life and godliness." You know, actually, we have it easy, because God's mapped out the path to us. We don't have to, as Paul said, go up into heaven and bring Christ down. We don't have to go down into the grave and bring Christ up. All we have to do is believe in the words right near our mouth and right near us. And so God has done the heavy lifting. What we have to do is light compared to what Jesus did. Sometimes when I'm taking the Lord's Supper and I'm tasting the fruit of the vine and saying to myself, "This is so sweet," I think about the bitter cup that Jesus had. And I suspect that there may be a reason, and that might be part of the reason that we're drinking the fruit of the vine, because he said, "Let this cup pass from me." But he took the cup and he said to them, "As often as you do it in remembrance of me." So verse 3, we have the divine power that has given to us all things that pertain to life and godliness through the knowledge of him who called us by glory and virtue. In other words, compared to what we should have in front of us, we have a pretty easy task ahead of us. Then in verse 4, "by which have been given to us exceedingly great and precious promises, that through these you may become partakers of the divine nature, having escaped the corruption that is in the world by lust." Now, once again, we have the means and the motivation here. The motivation are the precious and exceedingly great promises that we see afar off, that we embrace, that we look upon, and that lead us to confess we're strangers and pilgrims. Now, these precious and exceedingly great promises are based on the divine power that gave us to all things. That's why he says, "by which." And then he says, through these, through God's divine power and through the precious and exceedingly great promises that God has given, we can become partakers of the divine nature. And that's not going to be a burden. That's not going to be pushing the car. That's going to be effortless. The scriptures are designed to move us from where we are to where we need to be, and we only have to put forth the effort to trust them and exercise the self-control to do them. And that's Peter's point in his next section. For this very reason, giving all diligence, add to your faith virtue, knowledge, self-control, perseverance, godliness, brotherly kindness, and agape love. Now, some people see these as onerous. Brotherly kindness, you mean I have to like my brethren and I have to spend time with my brethren? What an onerous task, and sometimes it is. Sometimes brethren are the last people you want to be around. They're cantankerous, and they're frustrating, and you're pushing them, and it's like pushing something that just doesn't want to be pushed. You can pull a cow. It's tough to push one. Matter of fact, I wouldn't recommend it. Liable to get kicked. So these are the things that we do. And for some, this is onerous to have to add to your faith virtue and want to be the best you can be and gain the knowledge in the scriptures and all of these responsibilities. But verse 8, we see the promises again. If these things are yours and abound, you won't be barren or unfruitful. These are the natural motivations that will lead us to be busy and fruitful. In verse 9, he who lacks these things is short-sighted even to blindness, and has forgotten that he was cleansed from his old sins. Now, if you lack these things, Christianity is going to be really tough. Whoops, I thought I had one more. I guess I don't. Sorry. Let's do it like this. I tried something new here. I'm going back to my blank slide at the end. I don't like that. All right. But what do you think, brethren? Where are you at the end of this lesson? Are you, amen, 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 I know that's true, I've been doing it for years, and Christianity is a wonderful opportunity to make sacrifices that really make life meaningful. And then maybe some of you are here saying, I can see that there's some room for improvement. I need to change the way I'm thinking. And maybe some of you have reached a level where the burden has become so difficult that you've stopped doing some of the things you need to do. And maybe today is the day you need to come forward and ask God for forgiveness and change your priorities so that Christianity can be effortless. Because one of the most difficult things in the world is to have one foot in the world and one foot in the church. And going back and forth and feeling guilty both ways. And so as we open our songbooks now to number 343, and let him have his way with thee, again, this can be the most wonderful opportunity, or we can be singing this song saying, it's really hard for me to do this because of the price that has to be paid. And again, it all comes down to motivation. Motivation is the power, it's the gasoline, it's the electricity that makes Christianity effortless, light, and easy. And so as we sing this song, if anyone in the audience would like to be baptized into Christ or who would like to unburden themselves and confess their sins one to another so they can be healed, we give you that opportunity right now while we together stand and sing.